You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thord,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is... Writers, I have an amazing tool to tell you about. A revolutionary writing tool for planning stories, Campfire Pro is what novelists need to go from the seed of an idea to a detailed plan that's ready to be executed. Complete your character design, create a timeline, and track your world building all in one place with our downloadable desktop app for Mac and PC. Without the annoying subscription model so many apps are using today, visit campfiretechnology.com for special holiday pricing on Campfire Pro today. Who wants to love a billionaire? Billionaires in New York, Book 1 by Laura Burton. Do you have a favorite writer whose books are auto-buys for you? Wouldn't you love for readers to have you on their auto-buy list, then recommend your books to their friends and on social media? The good news is there are subtle things you can do, things that are nearly invisible to the reader, that will make your stories unputdownable. The Beyond 10 Days course from Victory Editing can help you get the most from your stories and help you build that relationship with readers through your writing. This course is full of awesome, and best of all, you don't have to fly across the country or put on pants. In this course, we'll focus on avoiding info dumps, dialogue mechanics, show versus tell in dialogue, carrying show versus tell forward to your narrative, deepening your point of view and strengthening your protagonist's voice, overwriting and how to avoid it. 10 hours of video content with text and audio downloads. Shine that diamond. Join me at the Beyond 10 Days course. Go to HankGarner.com and click the banner to sign up today. Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website, developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates. PubSite is the new, easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web. The Feisty Heroine Romance Collection of Short Stories. Over 30 plus pulse racing shorts to capture your heart with USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and award-winning authors in the mix. Paranormal, contemporary, fantasy, and historical romance that will whet your appetite with titillating, heart-pounding tales you'll want to read again, then beg for more. Fall in love with your next book crush. Pre-order this amazing collection of shorts, over 30 pulse-pounding stories, for only 99 cents.
Proceed with caution.
Buying this collection may lead to addictive reading, falling in love with your next book crush, and staying up past your bedtime to see what happens next.
Get your limited edition copy of Feisty Heroines. Look for the link in the show notes of this episode. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Nan Rossiter on the show with me today. She has an amazing new book. It's called Promises of the Heart. And I'll tell you what, this book has wide appeal. And if you don't love this book, I don't know that we can be friends. But welcome to the show, Nan.
Thanks, Hank. It's truly a pleasure to be here. I'm honored to be interviewed by you. So,
well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. We begin each show with the same question and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, actually, I came to writing pretty late in life because my earliest memory of being creative was when I was very young. I wanted to be an artist, and I never deviated from that. I always wanted to be an artist. Growing up, I loved to read, but if I had a book report to do, I would spend more time drawing the cover of the book report than working on the book report. So I just grew up wanting to be an artist, eventually deciding to go to art school, wanting to be an illustrator. So it wasn't until probably after I was married that I thought about becoming a writer. I had, when I was in high school, I had a teacher that suggested I consider becoming a writer. And again, in college, even though it was art school, we had to take classes like liberal arts classes. And I had a professor say that I should consider being a writer, but I just kind of brushed it off. And I only really wanted to be an illustrator.
Wow. Were you a bookish kid?
Very bookish. I read all the time, devoured books, rode my bike to the library all the time. I was a big fan of Harriet the Spy. And there was a series of mystery books called Alfred Hitchcock and the Three Investigators. And it was kind of...
I remember those. Those were fantastic. I'd forgotten all about those.
Yeah, everyone else was reading The Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew, and I loved those books. I read every one of them. So...
Those are fantastic. Nan, I'm always interested in the intersection between artistic expression, and I find it fascinating that you really wanted to be an illustrator and that the visual arts are what really got you going in the beginning. Now that you're a writer and have been to art school and, you know, you're accomplished in both areas, do you see that your time as a visual artist has inspired you as a writer or has given you tools that help you in storytelling now?
Well, after I graduated from art school, I freelanced for about 10 years. And then I grew tired of always drawing what other people wanted me to draw. And so I was trying to think of a way where I could focus on my own art and decided to write a children's book. And I don't know if you were aware of this, but I did end up writing and illustrating four children's books before I delved into women's fiction. And so I had never officially taken any sort of writing class or had any background in that, but writing the children's books it came easy to me. And of course I loved working on all the illustrations. And so that really was where it started. And then after I had published my third children's book, I didn't know a lot about publishing, and I didn't know about that public speaking would be part of it. That came as a surprise to me. So I started getting invited to schools to talk to the kids and being interviewed and things. And It was hard initially. I didn't expect it, and I wasn't fond of public speaking, but I got used to it. And so, but after my, and I didn't know all about how you have to really promote your book. It really falls on you to get out there and really push the book. I mean, the publisher does do initial push, but for you to keep going, you have to keep at it. And so after my third book didn't do as well as my first two, my publisher turned down my fourth idea. And so I went for about 9 years without publishing anything. I kept trying. I was a firm believer in perseverance, and I didn't give up, but I went for a long stretch without publishing anything. And about halfway through that period, I decided to write a novel. And so I drew from, you know, all the children's books ideas that I had worked on and written, and I just kind of, on a wing and a prayer, started writing, and the story took life of its own, and eventually was published. I mean, it took a long time, but so from your question, as far as art, and I'm very visual, so when I am writing, I almost see the story as a movie in my head. So, I don't know. I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. I love that. Speaking of that, to kind of carry on that thread, when you started writing that first book, did it begin with a visual? And how did that first story begin for you? If it kind of starts with a movie in your head, did you recognize that right away?
I did, because it had been kind of, it had been in my head for some time, just kind of, I've been thinking about it. I had a title. I had an idea. I had things that had inspired me for this specific story. And that book was called The Gin and Chowder Club. And I had always liked books about star-crossed lovers like Romeo and Juliet and Dr. Zhivago, The Bridges of Madison County. And I was drawn to that kind of a story, so that was really what started it. I also really liked A River Runs Through It. I love the way Norman Klain wrote. And as a nature lover myself, his writing was so lyrical. And it inspired me, and that's how I wanted to write. I knew I probably could never write that well, but that book, along with another writer that I was fond of, was Hal Borland. He used to write nature essays for the New York Times, and I just love the way he wrote about nature and was able to really see or describe the birds in the winter or the booming of the ice on the river in the winter and things like that. And so with that as my beginning and what I knew of writing, I set off to start writing The Gin and Chowder Club. And it was set in the summer of 1960 on Cape Cod. And it was about a young guy that got involved in a relationship that he shouldn't have. And I wanted the story to be authentic to the time. So I did a lot of research for that summer and what was going on in the world. And when I started writing, it just took on a life of its own. I walk every morning, and it's like I had written his name. His name was Asa Coleman. And I would walk in the morning, and the story would just start taking off in my head, and I would have to get back as quick as I could so I could start writing it down. So that book really, it was so easy to write. It's not the best book on earth, but a lot of people enjoyed it, and a lot of people didn't like it at all. But that usually is what happens with me visually. As soon as I write the character's name, they just sort of take over the story, and I trust them to lead the way.
I love that. What normally comes first for you, Nan? Is it when you start getting that visual of a story and then, you know, start getting, you know, the kind of emotional connections to that that lead to the story? Does it begin with a character? Does it begin with a place? Are you thinking about a situation and then these characters kind of show up to occupy that situation? How does that first kernel of story come to you? And has that changed over the, what are you up to, like 10 novels now?
Actually, the one that just came out is my eighth novel.
Eighth. Yep. Gotcha.
And so it varies. It's usually something I've read about or an experience I've had, and I draw on that. Like for another one of my books, I try to focus on struggles that we all go through, and I try to have characters that people can relate to and care about. And so one of my books was about three sisters whose mom passed away from Alzheimer's. And when I was writing that book, my mom had dementia. And so, you know, I was able to draw from my experience dealing with that and portray the feelings that I was feeling, or, you know, through my characters. When, you know, if you have to put a parent in a nursing home, how hard that is. And so the imagery in, you know, in my head, I can still picture my mom waving to me from the end of the hall when I was leaving, and it broke my heart then. And thinking about it now, it still does, you know, because she's trying to be brave and she's there by herself. And so those types of things are where I get my, you know, my experiences from. And so other than, you know, other things like, let's see, I've written about autism, Alzheimer's, a little bit about alcoholism when my characters had a drinking problem. They just come from life experience or what I've witnessed, and I don't really know how it starts, but something that's happened or something I've read has inspired the idea.
Well, speaking of that, the new book, Promises of the Heart, this is really a family drama at the heart of it, and in the kind of the purest sense. Tell us about Macy and Ben Samuelson. Who are these characters, and how did they come to you?
Well, it was actually the book was inspired by a little girl who we met on Cape Cod. We were at a Cape Cod League baseball game, and she came up to us because we had our dog with us, and she loved dogs. And she opened right up, and she started talking about how she had had a heart transplant and how her parents had gotten her a dog to help her get through it. And so she is, you know, you asked me about Macy and Ben, I know, but Harper is the character that.
There you are. I lost you for a second.
Okay.
You said Harper was the.
She was inspired by the little girl that we met. And so I know you asked me about Macy and Ben, but the story really was begun with that character, Harper. And
interesting.
So I built, you know, Macy and Ben were this couple. They were this couple that she was struggling to. She'd had several miscarriages, and she wasn't really open to the idea of adoption. And but through, they ended up adopting a three-legged dog, and he kind of pried open their hearts to considering adopting the little girl with the heart condition. So Macy was just this strong-willed redhead who was kind of set in her ways, always very vibrant, but having all these miscarriages had really set her back on her heels. And Ben was just the supportive, strong type, like most of my men. And he was also really not open to adoption, but I really wanted to kind of show characters that were able to be transformed by the idea of adoption. So,
and the character of Harper is this really interesting girl who has been in the foster care system, and you know, which brings challenges all its own. You know, when you've got a kid who feels like they've never belonged anywhere, and you know, integrating into a loving family is not always an easy thing. And then add to that that Harper has a heart condition. I really appreciate that you kind of show the good, the bad, and the ugly, you know, with this, that it's not always an easy journey. It's not always an easy transition. But that's where, you know, the love of this family really steps up. What did you do any specific research for this book? Do you know people that helped to kind of shape the way you looked at this family relationship?
I'm not close to anyone who has adopted kids, but I did have to research for the heart condition, and I was able to, you know, corner our own pediatrician to make sure I had all the symptoms correct and the treatment, and you know, make sure that it was authentic, that her symptoms would be right, and that sort of thing. So I can't speak to having close knowledge about adoption myself, but, you know, I've read about it. I've read stories of people that have adopted kids, and really that's where I got my information.
Gotcha. When you start to write a book, and you know, you told us kind of how that the creation process happens, when the story idea really comes to fruition, are you a planner? Do you plot out your books ahead of time, or are you discovering the story as you write?
I'm more of a discover the story as you write type of writer. I definitely have to have a proposal which lays out exactly where the story is going, what the plan is. You know, it's only a couple pages, but I can't just, you know, you have to have the proposal. Your editor wants to know what's going to happen. And so I do, as much as I don't like putting it down on paper that way, you know, you have to. And so, but I don't outline. I just sort of, as I said, I had never taken any classes on writing, so really, it's been a free for all. And I just start, you know, as soon as I write a character's name at the beginning of a chapter, they really do take over, and eventually I end up with like index cards all over my desk with notes, like things I have to remember to add in, and eventually I get to a certain point where I have to kind of jot down a timeline of what I expect in the last few chapters. But I don't know exactly what's going to happen or what a character is going to say along the way. But Harper was a great character to write, because as soon as I put her name at the beginning of a chapter, she would just start talking and do things that on her own. And I would just kind of follow along, and she was really a fun character to create and work with.
When would you do the proposal for your publisher in writing the book? Does the book ever kind of go off the rails and stray into a completely different story than you first imagined?
I haven't had that happen. I'm pretty good at staying on task. This book was a long time coming. I'm not sure if you know the backstory, but I.
Please share with us.
Okay. Well, I was with a different publisher and a different agent, and I had felt like I had reached a plateau in gaining an audience. And so I, after talking with some other author friends, I decided that it was time to make some changes. And it was a leap of faith to leave my agent and my publisher, my first 7 books. And so I had a new agent, and she was really excited to work with me, and she encouraged me to change my setting and, you know, try to write a different type of book. And so it's almost been 3 years since I had a book come out. And so when I was working on Promises of the Heart, there were actually 2 versions. One was very spirit. It had a lot of faith aspects to it. And then we weren't getting a lot of interest in it. And so I rewrote it and took out a lot of the faith aspects. I wanted to make it more mainstream. And we continued to submit it and continued to get rejected or no answer at all. And just no takers. I really felt like no one was even considering it. And then finally, my agent submitted to an editor, and she's at Harper, of course, and she read it in a weekend and loved it. And then when we were working on the edits for it, I started to work back in some of the faith aspects of it, and she was on board with that, which really made me happy, because that was the way I wanted it to be. And she never, you know, had any worries about it having the faith parts in it. And so finally, you know, for all that time, I was writing without a contract, didn't know if anyone was going to take it. And it was a test, to say the least, financially. And but when she took it, it was such a huge relief, and I'm so thankful that she did finally. So
do you find that there are seasons in publishing where certain books are more popular, or readers are looking for certain things? You know, when you mentioned that the book had more of a faith-based aspect at first, but wasn't really getting any bites, and then, you know, you got with Harper, and then you were able to add that back in. Do you feel like that some of those tastes wax and wane a little bit? And I really find it interesting, you know, as a writer, being able to be flexible to, you know, still keep the heart of the story, but maybe, you know, change some of the verbiage and things like that to, you know, to still be able to find a place in the market. Could you, since you've kind of been there before, can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I don't know. You know, I know there are books that are become popular. Everyone's looking for, you know, historical fiction, World War II genre, stories like that. But as far as the faith aspect, I think there is definitely a huge audience for books like this. And cannot be considered Christian fiction, because it's not. It's very strict. Christian fiction has very strict guidelines, and you can't have certain things in it. And so my books all have a thread of faith in them. But and I've had people, you know, you have readers that criticize you or say, you know, your book should be in Christian fiction. But not really, because all of my characters are sinners, and they swear.
As we all are.
Yep, that's how I feel about it. I just feel like they're real people who swear and drink and have premarital sex and so on and get into trouble. But so I can't fit into that genre. And I just try to write about real people facing the same, you know, real problems that we all face. And I like my characters to be authentic, and I like my readers to really care about them. Because for me, if I don't care about a character, I won't finish a book.
Sure.
And so I want them, the readers, to just, you know, feel like they've been there, or they can totally relate to how the character is feeling, and then find that you get through whatever situation. It's a struggle, and at the end, I try to have an uplifting ending, because I'm all about happy endings. You know, there could be a death, but that's life. And so I often try to show how sorrow and joys are hand in hand in life.
Right. Nan, in writing this book, Promises of the Heart, was there ever a case where one of the characters did something that completely surprised you and maybe took the story in a whole new way, or offered an opening for the story to grow in ways that you never saw?
Harper, you know, she grew throughout the book, and she started out being such a tough cookie and, you know, not willing to trust anyone. And, but she, over time, she just kind of, she did transform, and her behavior did surprise me at times. In the end, she struggled to trust the family that was willing to adopt her, Ben and Macy, but it was through the animals that they adopted too, that she was able, you know, she was ready to give them a chance just so that she could have the animals in her life. And I think that made all the difference. There's always animals in my books too.
Well, I love it. I love what you're doing in this book. It really opened my eyes to, you know, to some of the trials and successes that people have in, you know, a blended family like this, and the challenges, but the triumphs also. I mean, it's just a great book. Nan, what are you working on now that Promises of the Heart is out?
Well, first, thanks for the compliment on the book. I'm glad you liked it. And right now, this Promises of the Heart is the first in a series. It's the Savannah Skies series. So all my first books were set in New England, but now they're down in Georgia. And this one is first. And so I just submitted to my agent and my editor the next one in the series. It's called Dance of the Willows. And it's about Maeve, the younger sister, and her relationship with her boyfriend, Gage. And they both have secrets that they haven't been very completely forthcoming with each other about their past. And so they have to, for their relationship to grow, they both have to, you know, be more honest with what happened. And so that's what I've been working on. I'm happy to have it finished, and I'm eager to work on proposals for the next book in the series.
I love it. Nan, if people are just learning about you and discovering your work, is there a place where they can connect with you online to dig into your back catalog and check out all the great stuff that you do?
Absolutely. I have a website, nanrossiter.com. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram, all the social media sites, Twitter, not very much on Twitter, but so absolutely. And they're all available. And be great to have people look at my backlist if they like this one.
Excellent. We're going to put links to all of it in the show notes of this episode, and we'll send people to your site to check out all the great stuff that you do. Nan, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show today.
And thank you, Hank. It's been a pleasure.
Stay tuned now for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War.
The near future. humanity's only hope of survival, enter the solar system at nearly the speed of light. The probe slowed as the sun's heliosphere disrupted the graviton wave it rode in on from the abyss of deep space. Awakened by the sudden deceleration, the probe absorbed the electromagnetic spectrum utilized by its target species and assessed the technological sophistication of the sole sentient species on Earth. The probe adjusted its course to take it into the system's primary. If the humans couldn't survive, with its help, what was to come? Then the probe would annihilate itself. There would be no trace of it for the enemy, and no chance of humanity's existence beyond the time it had until the enemy arrived. The probe analyzed filed patents, military expenditures, birth rates, mathematical advancement, and space exploration. The first assessment fell within the margin of error of survival and extinction for humanity. The probe's programming allowed for limited, autonomous decision-making, choice being a rare luxury for the probe's class of artificial intelligence. The probe found itself in a position to choose between ending its mission in the sun's fire and a mathematically improbable defense of humanity, and the potential compromise of its much larger mission. Given the rare opportunity to make its own decision, the probe opted to dither. In the week it took to pass into Jupiter's orbit, the probe took in more data. It scoured the internet for factors to add to the assessment, but the assessment remained the same. Unlikely, but possible. By the time it shot past Mars, the probe still hadn't made a decision. As the time to adjust course for Earth or continue into the sun approached, the probe conducted a final scan of cloud storage servers for any new information, and found something interesting. While the new information made only a negligible impact on the assessment, the probe adjusted course to Earth. It hadn't traveled all this way for nothing. In the desert south of Phoenix, Arizona, it landed with no more fanfare than a slight thump and a few startled cows. Then it broke into the local cell network and made a call. Mark Ibarra awoke to his phone ringing at max volume, playing a pop ditty that he hated with vehemence. He rolled off the mattress that lay on the floor and crawled on his hands and knees to where his cell was recharging. His roommate, who paid the majority of their rent and got to sleep on an actual bed, grumbled and let off a slew of slurred insults. Mark reached his cell and slapped at it until the offending music ended. He blinked sleep from his eyes and tried to focus on the caller's name on the screen. The only people who'd call at this ungodly hour were his family in Basque country, or maybe Jessica in his applied robotics course wanted a late-night study break. The name on the screen was Answer Me. He closed an eye and reread the name. It was way too early, or too late, depending on one's point of view, for this nonsense. He turned the ringer off and went back to bed. Sleep was about to claim him when the phone rang again, just as loudly as last time, but now with a disco anthem.
Seriously?
His roommate slurred. Mark declined the call and powered the phone off. He flopped back on his bed and curled into his blanket.
To hell with my first class, he thought.
Arizona State University had a lax attendance policy, one which he'd abused for nights like this. The cell erupted with big band music. Mark took his head out from beneath the covers and looked at his phone like it was a thing possessed. The phone vibrated so hard that it practically danced a jig on the floor, and the screen flashed Answer Me over and over again as music blared.
Dude,
said his roommate, now sitting up in his bed. Mark swiped the phone off the charging cord, and the music stopped. The caller's name undulated with a rainbow of colors, and an arrow appeared on the screen, pointing to the button he had to press to answer the call. "When did I get this app?" he thought. Mark sighed and left the bedroom, meandering into the hallway bathroom with the grace of a zombie. The battered mattress he slept on played hell with his back and left him stiff every morning. Dropping his boxers, he took a seat on the toilet and answered the call, determined to return this caller's civility with some interesting background noise. "What?" he murmured. "Mark Ibarra, I need to see you." The voice was mechanical, asexual in its monotone. "Do you have any friggin' idea what time it is? Wait, who the hell is this?" "You must come to me immediately. We must discuss the mathematical proof you have stored in document title This Can't Be Right. Doc. Mark shot to his feet. The boxers around his ankles tripped him up, and he stumbled out of the bathroom and fell against the wall. His elbow punched a hole in the drywall, and the cell clattered to the floor. He scooped the phone back up and struggled to breathe as a sudden asthma attack came over him.
How?
He couldn't finish his question until he found his inhaler in the kitchen, mere steps away in the tiny apartment. He took a deep breath from the inhaler and felt the tightness leave his lungs. That someone knew of his proof was impossible. He'd finished it earlier that night and had encrypted it several times before loading it into a cloud file that shouldn't have been linked to him in any way.
"How do you know about that?"
he asked. "You must come to me immediately. There is little time. Look at your screen," the robotic voice said. His screen changed to a map program, displaying a pin in an open field just off the highway, connecting Phoenix to the suburb of Maricopa. "Come. Now." Mark grabbed his keys. An hour later, his jeans ripped from scaling a barbed wire fence, Mark was surrounded by desert scrub. The blue of the morning rose behind him, where his beat-up Honda waited on the side of the highway. With his cell to his ear, Mark stopped and looked around before deciding how to continue. Spiked ocotillo plants looked a lot like benign mesquite trees in the darkness. A Native American casino in the distance served as his North Star, helping him keep his bearings.
"You're not out here, are you? I'm being punked, aren't I?"
he asked the mysterious caller. "You are 9.26 meters to my east-southeast. Punk, decayed wood, used as tinder. Are you on fire?" the caller said. Mark rolled his eyes. This wasn't the first time the caller had used the non-standard meanings of words during what passed as conversation between the two. Mark had tried to get the caller to explain how he knew about his theorem and why they had to meet in the middle of the desert. The caller had refused to say anything. He would only reiterate that Mark had to come quickly to see him, chiding him every time Mark deviated from the provided driving directions.
"If you're so close, why can't I see you?"
he asked. He took a few steps in what he thought was a northwesterly direction and squished into a cow patty.